When I start the clock, you'll have a green light with your full 20 minutes. It's going to switch to yellow at 3 minutes. You can continue, but if you do, you'll be using the time you reserved.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, these guaranteed investment contracts are long-term contracts that have as their expiration date somewhere between 2047 and 2051, depending on the contracts. By their terms, they are negotiated contracts that require AIG to accept bond funds into a specialized account to support the specific development, construction, and operation of these privatized military housing. Under the GICS, plaintiffs were to invest hundreds of millions of dollars over time. And fundamentally, these contracts were designed to protect plaintiffs' principal and not simply allow AIG, when there's a ratings event downgrade, to return the money and say the contracts are over. At its core, AIG's argument depends on reading contract language into these agreements that simply do not exist. It also depends on reading provisions out of the agreement that do exist.
Counsel, what exactly is the issue that we're being asked to decide?
The core issue, I think, for this court, and there's two of them, but the first primary core issue for the court is whether 3.2 is an acceleration clause. AIG interprets 3.2 to be an acceleration clause, and the court below agreed. But it is not as a matter of law. And the reason why is the distinguishing feature of an acceleration clause.
Well, before you get to that, what's the second issue?
The second issue has to do whether or not we're allowed to collect, the plaintiffs are allowed to collect damages under the contracts as a result of AIG's alleged breach.
Under New York law?
Under New York law, that's correct, sir.
And what was the trial court's rationale that 3.2 is an acceleration clause, and why is that wrong?
The trial court actually did not have much of a rationale other than to indicate that since a payment was being made ahead of the expiration date, it was an acceleration clause. But the analysis that the court should have engaged in is it should have determined whether or not legally there was language that accelerated the maturity date of that 3.2 acceleration clause. And the cases are uniform, in all the cases cited before this court, that the distinguishing feature of an acceleration clause is language that accelerates the maturity date. And you will uniformly see in these acceleration clauses, as identified by the New York courts, language that says the clause it makes the principal interest immediately due and payable. Notably, 3.2 contains no such language. There is no...
two questions. Number one, does there have to be magic language in a contract provision for it to constitute an acceleration clause, or is it sufficient, as the Superior Court apparently found, that the operative language has that effect? The second question is, does it really matter? That is it really an issue as to whether or not the clause in question is an acceleration clause? Because it appears from the facts that even if there was no right to accelerate, AIG offered to do so, that your client could have turned the offer down but didn't and took the money and for 3 years went on to other things.
Well, as to the first question, yes, magic language is required.
If you don't call it an acceleration clause, that even if by every other indication and functional test it is an acceleration clause, it won't be treated that way by the law?
No, that's not what we're saying, actually. By every indication and functional test, it's not an acceleration clause. An acceleration clause must accelerate the maturity date. The parties knew how to draft an acceleration clause when they wanted to, and that's 5.2. 5.2 contains two acceleration clauses. Both contain the magic language. Both expressly accelerate the maturity date by including immediately due and payable language.
Okay, so there has to be some kind of magic language.
Yes, sir.
It has to have the word accelerate.
No, I don't think it has to have the word accelerate, but the key to acceleration clause is the maturity date is being accelerated. And a simple payment does not accelerate the maturity date.
Well, so, if the word accelerate does not appear, then can it constitute an acceleration clause?
I think functionally the answer to that is probably yes. However, you, again, need language showing that you intended to accelerate the maturity date, which is the key characteristic of an acceleration clause, and that is not here.
What was the consequence, in your view, of your client taking the money, cashing the check? You know, I'm sure there probably wasn't a check today, but your client took the money. What was the consequence?
The consequence was we were accepting a 3.2 repayment. There was no, and that was a payment that was being made pursuant to a stated obligation. There was no dispute of any kind. Therefore, AIG was performing in accordance with the contract. It had no right to addend any additional terms to its payment.
Well, aren't you overlooking a very critical fact in answering Justice Holland's question, which is that in the documents that tendered a return of the principal due, plus whatever interest that accrued, the document said that upon acceptance, our contract will terminate.
Yes, there's no question that.
So why didn't it terminate once your client took the money?
Because there was no dispute, there was no need for an accord and satisfaction. AIG was operating and making a payment as they were required to do, and under the law, they are not allowed to implement and
excuse me. Well, did your client write back to AIG saying, "We'll take the money, but we don't accept your condition"? You don't have any right to impose that condition. Is there anything on the record that shows that that it took that it made some objection to the termination language?
No, sir. Because under the law, they didn't have to, and under the contract, they didn't have to.
Did I hear you correctly? Did you just say a moment ago that AIG was making a payment it was required to do?
Yes, under 3.2, they had various options of what to do when there's a ratings downgrade, and they elected to of those options to make a repayment.
Well, if it's required, then it's an acceleration clause, isn't it?
No, sir, it's not, because, the critical feature of an acceleration clause is that the maturity date, by language, is accelerated, and that's not happening here. This is simply an option by the debtor to make a payment. Acceleration clauses have to have an accelerated maturity date, and they are always in favor of and at the option of the creditor. But that's not the case here. And that's an additional features of why this provision, pursuant to which payment was made, was not an acceleration payment.
Could AIG have done something other than make the payment?
Yes, under 3.2, they had various options that are spelled out in the contract.
Well, this takes me back to Justice Jacobs' question. If they had several options and they pick one and they condition the option on termination and your client accepts the money knowing it's conditioned on termination, why isn't there a termination?
Because they had no right to graft onto their required payment an additional condition. They are performing pursuant to the contract, and under the law they cannot say, oh, we're going to add this new contractual term with no consideration, by the way.
An argument that of which you gave no notice to the other side. That is, when you took the money, you never gave any notice that you were taking it but not acceding to the condition for taking the money, namely that the contract would terminate.
That's right. We did not give them notice, Your Honor, because under the contract.
That's a heads I win, tails you lose position that AIG is being put in, isn't it?
I don't believe that's fair, Your Honor, because actually what they were trying to do was graft on a term that was unfair. In fact, their attempt.
Well, if it was unfair, then why didn't your client say so?
Because there was no need to do that under the circumstances.
Well, there may be under the law of contracts where the party's intent is objectively determined. And objectively, your client took the money subject to that condition and never protested the condition. So under that view, why doesn't that conclude the case?
Because under the contract, it was accepting a payment that was required. It had no obligation to speak under 6.3 and 6.4. The contract could not be modified unless in writing. And AI, since there was no dispute between the parties.
By the way, the condition, the termination condition was in writing.
I essentially agree there was no right for them to declare a termination or impose that condition on us. And there's no obligation under the contract or under the law when there's no dispute to speak and dispute that attempted imposition of a term. That is
well,
not.
If it's a discretionary act, why cannot they impose a condition under New York law?
Because when a party's performing to a contract and performing an obligation under a contract, it has no right to unilaterally say, I'm going to perform under the contract as required, but I'm going to impose this additional condition on you. They have no right to do that. Certainly, there's no consideration for that. And that's essentially what happened here.
Well, let's hypothetically, we'll assume that there really was a paper check with the money, principal and interest, and it, the check had a note that said, payment in full, 3.2, agreement completely terminated. And then the check was endorsed on the back. They took the money. Would that constitute a writing?
Perhaps it would constitute a writing. But again, AI, there would be no consideration for that additional term. And AIG, who would be sending the check in accordance with a required performance, has no right to inject that term and require acceptance in order for us to accept the money.
So no matter what it said on the check, let's assume on the back of the check, it said, by endorsing this check, payee fully releases, waives all claims under the contract, da-da-da-da-da, as precise a language that could make it crystal clear that it was intended to end the agreement. That still wouldn't do it.
Your Honor, I believe that still wouldn't do it because there is no dispute that would lead to an accord and satisfaction. If there was a known dispute, or if a contract had not been formed and the obligations weren't clear, I think you would have a very good point. But here they were tendering payment and trying to impose unilaterally a condition that they weren't allowed to do. And so I don't believe that by signing the check under that example, that you would have accepted that termination provision that was not there before.
So if there was a separate document, release of obligations under the contract in consideration of the payment of X, that would be invalid?
By accepting the check with those conditions, we would not be accepting those conditions since they are outside the contract and the contract specifically provides you cannot modify that contract without a writing that's signed by both parties. Now, here the parties obviously, there was no check that was signed. There was no mutual writing by the parties.
Well, if there was no right to impose the termination condition or to propose the termination condition, isn't it also the case that there was no right, that your client had no right to take the money?
No, I don't think that's correct, because under 3.2, they had several options, AIG had several options, and they elected to the repay option, and they had to repay within a set amount of time, 10 days. Again, the maturity date was not accelerated, but they had to repay within 10 days.
Well, AIG had several options. It didn't have to propose the option that it, in fact, did propose. But it chose to do it, but only if your client would agree that that if it took the money, the contract would terminate. Your client didn't have to accept that condition. She could have said no. employing one of the other contractual options, but it didn't do that. It accepted the money, and it didn't, from all indication, it accepted the condition by not protesting and not doing anything inconsistent with that interpretation of the events for 3 years.
AIG had essentially three options. It chose one of those options, and we accepted payment pursuant to that option. We had no obligation to speak up and say these additional terms that you're trying to graft on.
Why didn't you have an obligation to speak up?
Because AIG had a contractual obligation to make that payment. Under the law, they had no right to say, yeah, we're going to make this payment that we owe you, but we're going to graft on some additional terms that aren't there pursuant to the contract.
You're saying AIG had no right even to propose it? That's all they did. They didn't inflict it on you. They proposed it, and your client accepted it.
They proposed it, but also sent an obligatory payment along with it. And we did cash the check, but there's absolutely no indication that we accepted the term that they proposed.
No indication? You took the money. You didn't object to the condition. And for 3 years, your client went on its merry way and did something else until after 3 years it said, ho-hum, maybe we can do better if we go back to AIG. Let's see if we can revive this contract. Do you really think the law operates or should operate that way?
I do think the law should operate that a party cannot, when it has a mandatory payment, make that payment, but then inject a new term in there that's mandatory. And therefore, if you're going to accept a payment that's obligated, you are forced to, as they propose, to accept another term. I'm not aware of law that says that under these circumstances, when there's a requirement of a writing by both parties to modify a contract, that by accepting a payment that's obligated, you somehow accept yet another term that's not in the contract.
In other words, your client was free to take the money and remain silent, and only if it wrote, put something in writing in response that said, yes, we accept those terms, would it be bound?
Yes, I believe that's the case. I think if we were going to be bound by a new provision that they're proposing that's not in the contract, as required by the contract, we would have to have indicated affirmative assent to that condition.
And we've asked you a lot of questions. As you probably know, we've read your brief, and you want to save the remaining time for rebuttal?
I would, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, John Pickard on behalf of the defendants AIG and AIG Match Funding Corporation. Your Honors, this is a case much like the In Re Solutia case in which damages were denied because, as the Court found, there were no expectations that have been dashed. And in this case, the plaintiffs have received exactly the performance that they negotiated for, which was if AIG ever encountered financial difficulties signified either by a ratings downgrade or by some other indication of financial distress, that they would get the optimal protection for their principal, which is that it would be repaid in full. And in the wake of them receiving what they negotiated for, they are not entitled to seek expectation damages, nor are they entitled to 3 years later seek to revive the contract.
Why can't there be multiple debts with a contract term going to 2047? Absent an express signed document modifying the contract, why doesn't it continue in force?
Well, there are multiple reasons. The first reason is that, in fact, this was an acceleration of the amounts that were being held in connection with the contract. 3.2 is an acceleration clause like 5.2. And the courts have been clear, and NML is a good example of it, that where there has been an acceleration and the repayment of principal, the obligations under the contract cease to continue to exist. And they have not cited to a single case where there has been acceleration and repayment under a loan agreement, and there has been the ability to continue to enforce the terms of the agreement.
So, so 3.2, you're saying, is functionally speaking an acceleration clause, even though the word acceleration doesn't appear?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. The way 3.2 works is if AIG does not provide collateral or assign the loan, then it must, within 10 days, repay the full amount that is being held under the agreement.
Turning briefly to the damage issue, which we did not reach, Mr. William was presenting his case. Is it correct, is it your position that the plaintiff cannot seek expectation damages because expectation damages in this case would constitute unearned interest, which is precluded as a matter of New York law?
That's absolutely the case, Your Honor. There are a whole line of cases holding that you can't seek unearned interest where there has been a return of principal. And this case falls squarely within that established precedent.
Well, I should say the courts, it appears that you can't get unearned interest unless the contract provides that you can.
That's correct. There are exceptions to that rule, and the primary exception is where the contract expressly provides for the payment of some type of post-acceleration amount. And these types of provisions are well known to people like the plaintiffs. The plaintiffs are large real estate companies. They know how acceleration provisions work. And when parties negotiate for contracts that have acceleration provisions, they can provide for provisions called yield maintenance or make-whole provisions that would do exactly what the plaintiffs are asking this court to do through providing expectation damages, which is that to provide for the loss of future income stream off of the amounts that are no longer being held on deposit. But in the absence of them having negotiated for that type of a provision, the courts are crystal clear. They are not entitled to get that as a form of expectation damages.
Help me understand how this agreement was supposed to work through 2047. Let's assume we never had the financial crisis in 2008. Everything was going happily. AIG was paying the money, wasn't given back. If they had come to AIG and said, we have some more money we'd like to place with you, would AIG have to take it?
Well, in fact, Your Honor, if they had more money, they were required to come to AIG and deposit it with AIG. This was not a case, a contract on which there were discretionary deposits, which is what they're now claiming that they are allowed to do. The contract provides that they had to deposit all funds off of these bond issuances, whether they are funds that they got on day one at the closing or funds that they received later. They were required to deposit all funds with AIG, and AIG was required to accept all funds. Well, that was the nature of the agreement.
Thank you. I'm just trying to see how the chronology fits together.
Sure.
Because what you're saying is when we gave you back your principal plus interest, the agreement was terminated. And the other argument we see in the briefs is they came in 3 years later and say, we have some additional money. And, you know, you just said if all things had remained perfect, you'd have to take the money. But what you're now saying is it doesn't matter whether you have additional money or not, because our relationship ended 3 years ago when there was a termination. Is that right?
That is correct.
The termination does two things. It ends any obligation that had accrued at the time the money was paid, and it eliminated any future opportunities to provide additional money.
That's right. Now, they could have waived that at the time. If they had wanted to continue leaving their money invested with AIG and receiving the same rate of return and depositing additional funds, you know, continuing to comply with their obligations under the agreement, they had that opportunity to do that back in 2008. They elected not to. They elected to take the protection of receiving their principal back pursuant to notices that said that the agreement was hereby terminated. They elected to not perform their obligations under the agreement by continuing to deposit whatever additional funds they had over the ensuing three years.
So is your position that was a breach by Fort Benning, which excused further performance by AIG?
It was, Your Honor, although I think it was a couple of things. It certainly was a breach, which means they can't recover for breach themselves because they can't establish the element of a breach claim that they have complied with the terms of the agreement if the agreement still existed. But in addition, it's indicia of the fact that they did not believe that this agreement still stayed in force and in effect.
Well, it's also my understanding that the termination argument that Justice Holland articulated is clearly your position. But I also thought, and maybe this verges on the metaphysical, that there was an additional argument, and that is even if this contract somehow remained alive, even so, the plaintiff would have had no enforceable right to perform any further under it because by not depositing monies as required by the literal terms of the contract, it was in breach. And as the party in breach, it can't now seek enforcement of the contract.
That's absolutely the case, Your Honor. This is not a checking account where you can take money out and put it in as you want. And Section 2.3 of the agreement says that very clearly. They are not entitled to just withdraw and then redeposit funds. And so not having performed their obligations under the contract, if the contract was enforced, which obviously it's my client's position that it wasn't, but if they were right, then they would have been in breach and they are then not entitled to seek damages for a breach by AIG.
That was argued to the Superior Court?
I believe it was, Your Honor, that this would constitute a breach if this agreement was still in force.
Was there a basis for the court's ruling? An alternative ground that you're presenting for us to affirm?
Your Honor, the court's ruling with respect to this portion was relatively short. And so exactly what the court's reasoning was, was not evident other than that the court said that at this juncture 3 years later, that the plaintiffs are not entitled to force themselves on AIG.
Right, and you translate that to mean two things. Number one, that is an evidentiary matter. That behavior establishes that even the plaintiff believed that the contract had terminated. But secondly, as a legal matter, because no monies were deposited or anything else done within those 3 years, the plaintiff would have been in breach by the time that it tried to revive whatever rights it had. But that argument, which is in your brief, I gather would be an alternative ground for affirmance, not a ground that was addressed by the court clearly.
That is correct, Your Honor. That is correct. I think there are two clear grounds upon which the court could affirm that the reinvestments were not permitted. One is that this was an acceleration which by law terminated the agreements. And the second is that there was agreement among the parties that this was a termination as evidenced by a number of things. The termination notices, the failure to make any further deposits under the agreement in the ensuing 3 years, the breach of the agreement in making deposits elsewhere when they are obligated to deposit all funds. I think the court can also take note of the context in which these attempted deposits were made. It was in the wake of the Superior Court below having indicated that it was going to dismiss the claims for expectation damages, and this was clearly a manufactured effort to try to create a breach to revive not just the contract, but to revive its legal case. And then the fifth reason is because their fundamental argument is that there was a default under Section 5 of the agreement and an acceleration under Section 5.2. And so this whole point with respect to whether there was an acceleration, the essence of their claim is that, in fact, there was an acceleration under 5.2, which they, the import of that would be, under their own logic, that there was a termination. So for all five of those reasons, we think it is, clear that they did not themselves believe that this agreement was still in force and in effect, and the court can affirm on those grounds.
Well, let's go back to basics, so to speak. This is a motion to dismiss, so we don't it's not a motion for summary judgment. We're looking at the pleadings, and someone has made a determination, the Superior Court's made a determination, you're out of court as a matter of law. As I understand your first position in its simplest form, it is if you look at the agreement and the complaint, you see that they took the money, it was tendered conditioned on a termination, end of case.
That's correct, Your Honor. I don't think the court need go any further than that. The law is, you know, clear in New York. You can condition a payment upon terms, and they accepted that payment.
Even if it's the payment pursuant to the contract, it's an additional term that's permitted?
Yes, Your Honor, as long as they continue to act consistent with the fact that they believe this is terminated. You don't need to look at that in a vacuum. This was, you know, it was conditioned, you know, upon there being a termination. They not only cashed the check that was conditioned upon that, which we think would be enough, but then they acted consistent with the agreement being terminated by taking the funds and investing them elsewhere when then they were under a contractual obligation to invest them with AIG.
On that latter point, do we find that in the complaint?
Yes, Your Honor. The complaint at paragraph 52 concedes that under the terms of the GIC, they were required to deposit proceeds from taxable revenue bonds. So it acknowledges that they had an obligation to deposit those funds. And then in paragraph 172, they acknowledge that they have invested the funds with others, and that's the basis for their damage claim. So you can put together those two paragraphs, and they say we had an obligation to deposit all the funds. We deposited the funds with somebody else, and the court can find on the face of the pleadings that they didn't comply with the obligations that are they themselves acknowledged to be part of the contract.
So all of the facts that we've been collectively discussing are facts of which we can take cognizance even on a motion to dismiss the complaint.
Absolutely, Your Honor. All of these facts come directly from...
Can you clarify something for me as well? On 172, the other funds that they deposited, is that referring to the funds that AIG paid back, or is that referring in addition to the other bond monies that they would have been obligated to deposit with AIG?
It certainly is at least referring to the funds that were repaid, that those funds were repaid and they were required and they deposited them with somebody else. They don't talk specifically, I will acknowledge, with respect to the additional funds. But that, Your Honor, goes to one of the earlier questions, which is, well, was this agreement intended to work that you could then repay certain amounts and deposit additional amounts in the future? And the way the agreement was structured is the agreement says that all funds must be deposited with AIG. It doesn't provide for a mechanism where there's a payment of certain funds and then future additional investments. The obligations go to all funds. So if they were right that following acceleration, that the contract stays in effect, what that would mean is that upon AIG returning all of the funds, they would have been under a simultaneous obligation to redeposit those exact same funds with AIG. And that doesn't make any sense. That certainly was not the intent of the parties, which is a further reason why the acceleration was itself intended to terminate all of the obligations under the agreement.
Well, and I guess the logic of that is AIG didn't want to have to take funds in the future and pay a higher rate of return when it was already having financial problems anyway.
That is certainly the case, Your Honor. And in addition, this was not meant to be an option agreement where the plaintiffs could decide to pull out funds, and what if interest rates had gone up? They certainly weren't supposed to be able to pull out funds, go and deposit them elsewhere for a greater rate of return, and then wait for 20 years until interest rates went down, and then go and then redeposit them with AIG. That was not the nature of the agreement, but that would be the effect of what plaintiffs are here arguing.
Well, just from a purely legal standpoint, even if we could not take cognizance of the fact the plaintiffs reinvested the funds that were returned to them during the 3 years following the termination. That wouldn't be critical to your case. Is that correct?
No, that is correct, Your Honor. You still have them two things. You have the effect of the acceleration, which we say by law terminated the agreement. And secondly, you have them accepting funds pursuant to notices that say that, you know, this hereby terminates the agreement. Unless the court has any further questions,
thank you.
I'm happy to see the rest of my time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Let me start by picking up on the discussion that the court was having with counsel, and that is these issues of prior breach, abandonment, silence. Those are all factual issues. The case law is all uniform that those issues are factual in nature, and AIG has not cited one case that indicates that prior breach, that abandonment, that silence, that all of these factual issues that are being thrown around can be decided on a motion to dismiss. Indeed, there are...
Well, why not, if they're a reasonable inference from the complaint itself?
Because we don't believe they're a reasonable inference from the complaint. Whether or not a prior breach is an excuse for AIG after 3 years to accept, not to accept these revenues, these funds, in the light of a 40-year contract is an issue of a fact.
Well, the fact that your client had no further dealings with AIG for 3 years after the purported termination is a fact that's not a dispute.
That is not in dispute, but it's reasonable, Your Honor, and it's reasonable because at that point in time, AIG was in...
But it's not in dispute, and therefore whatever legal consequence flows from it. That is, it is an undisputed fact that can be taken into account in determining the merits of the motion to dismiss.
Yes, but whether that undisputed fact equates to a legal doctrine that results in dismissal isn't there, because the fact that we were silent for 3 years...
Isn't fair?
I don't believe it's fair, Your Honor.
Is that relevant to the legal issue of whether there was a termination?
Well, the fact that we were silent for 3 years doesn't equate to a legal doctrine that results in dismissal.
Well, that's the issue, isn't it? Why not?
Why not? Because it's a factual dispute. Whether or not a prior breach excuses their subsequent breach is a factual issue.
Well, and we're not even conceding. This contract, by its terms, goes to 2047. If it wasn't 3 years, what if it was five? If it was 10? Is there a point in time when it would cross the line from your perspective?
Well, that's our point exactly. Whether or not there is a point in line, in time where you would cross the line is exactly what fact finders decide, and that's why it's a fact issue.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you both for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement and will also recess. Yes.